Chapter 1, we are here to remember. Top of chapter quote by James Dellingpole. David Icke is a visionary genius. Anyone who doesn't realize this at this late stage of the game is deluded, ignorant, or foolish. Who would have thought, amid the decades of ridicule and abuse, that those words would have been written one day by a respected proper journalist about that nutter, David Icke? Very close to no one. I hope that my life experience has shown how important it is to speak your truth, whatever that may be, no matter what the actions and reactions of others. Humanity has been manipulated into a reality bubble through thousands of years of what we call time to see self and life in a myopia so small, so microscopic, that only the basic functions of survival constitute the perception of living. This is changing as ever more minds awaken from the trance, but it remains the case for great swathes of the human family. Therefore, anyone exposing, thinking, feeling, knowing beyond those walls of myopic perception is going to face ridicule, abuse, and dismissal from those who literally cannot compute or process the expanded sense of reality being communicated. We must speak our truth, nevertheless. We must. Without that unwavering determination to challenge the holding pattern of convention, nothing can change. Perception eddies continue to spin while the rest of the river, infinite possibility, flows by unseen and unacknowledged. I decided when my mind awakened in 1990 and then crashed open early the following year that I was going to speak my truth. No level of abuse was going to stop me. To put this in human terms, I'm a stubborn bastard. So stubborn, in fact, that like the keystone of an archway, the more pressure you apply, the stronger I get. This strength is not human, it is beyond human. I am not human. Neither are you. Human is the great illusion and the foundation of our mass servitude. We are not human. We are consciousness having a brief experience called human. Here lies the revelation that will set us free. I am living an amazing life. Amazing. And I would not change a day of it, the good, bad, or the bits in between. If I did, I would break the interconnectedness that has shown me so much on so many levels and in so many facets that have conjured the magic that has led me to where I am today. I love where I am today, so why would I want to change the incredible tapestry of experience that got me here? I would, however, like to change many of the things I have been made aware of in a life of extraordinary synchronicity since my consciousness exploded awake in 1990 and 91, and I was launched into a blaze of mass ridicule and abuse, and ultimately, 3 decades later, to vindication. Possibly hundreds of millions around the world have acknowledged my vindication and more all the time, while there are still many who seek to avoid the blatant truth that I have been vindicated. They can only do so through self-deception. I have said for those more than 30 years that current events were coming, and here they are. The question is, how? How did I know? Why are things that I said, which are most far out, increasingly being supported by mainstream scientists? After all, I left school at 15 to play professional football with no exam certificates. To the intellectual mind, that is a paradox. How could I know without a proper education? I could know because the world is not what people think it is, or more to the point, are told it is. The intellectual mind must be the servant of expanded states of consciousness. Instead, the intellect has long been the master and not the servant. When that happens, the cell door slams shut on wisdom, on knowing, and our world is the result. I'm going to outline key moments in my life in the opening chapters to provide a, quote, human life blueprint with which to compare the seriously deep levels of reality, which we will explore later. My life experience will also give you the background to where my information has come from these last 32 years as I pass my 70th year on Madhouse Earth. I arrived here in Earth Year 1952, and like many today, I had a mission to wrest control of human perception from the clutches of a deeply evil, inverted force that manifests in countless different ways that I will be exposing. I didn't consciously know this, of course, as I grew up on a council estate in Leicester, England, went to school and pursued a career in professional football. Nor did I know this when that career ended with arthritis and when I went on to be a newspaper, radio and television journalist, a nationally known sports presenter with the BBC. I didn't know when, out of nowhere, I became a national spokesman for the British Green Party in the late 1980s. But I did know, after a visit to a psychic in 1990, and when my sense of reality was blown apart on a hill in Peru in 1991. They talk about life-changing moments. That doesn't even begin to tell the story of what happened to me that day. I will describe all of these experiences and so many more as we go along. They are essential background to how I could call current events and be way ahead of mainstream science many times over three decades. I have learned, the real term should be remembered, as we'll see, so many things, including the fact that there is no death, and what we call death is only a transition between different expressions of life. Far from being pawns in someone else's game, we can control our experienced reality if we know how to do so. If we don't, then we are pawns in someone else's game, and that's the stark situation that almost everyone faces. I have learned, remembered, the nature of the psychopathic force behind all this, how it operates through its hidden networks, and to what end. Knowing the what end has allowed me to predict current events. I've also been shown to allow me to remember that what we call the human world is a massively advanced version of a virtual reality computer system created to entrap our sense of reality and imprison our lower consciousness in an ever-recycling feedback loop between different levels of this simulation or matrix. This process has become known as reincarnation. The physics of our reality and computer games are the same, as highlighted by physicist and cosmologist Max Tegmark at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT. Who would have thought, amid the frenzy of ridicule that once descended upon me, that they would read a headline that said, We owe David Icke an apology if quantum experiment proves we are living in a matrix, end quote. Or that the article would start with this line, whisper it, but many respected scientists and academics are becoming increasingly convinced by left-field provocateur David Icke's assertion that our reality is an artificial simulation, end quote. Who would have believed when I said soon after the millennium that we live in a simulation and its walls are the speed of light, that 20 years later an article in the mainstream Scientific American would come to the same conclusion? How could I know this so much earlier with no exam passes or academic instruction beyond the basics? That will become clear. And this is the point. The ability to do this is open to everyone. It should be our natural state. To understand the simulation is to understand human society, and to understand human society is to understand perception. We shall see that perception is both the foundation of human control and the means that can set us free of that control. The simulation or matrix is a manipulator of perception because that which is behind the simulation knows that from perception everything else comes. Every last fine detail of experience. I was born on April 29th, 1952. In an inner city area of Leicester in the English East Midlands. Our terraced house was in Lead Street, which ran into Wharf Street, so you get the picture. Lead Street was demolished in a slum clearance scheme pretty soon after I was born. My earliest memory is sitting in an austere room at a grim empty table, except for a bottle of sterilised milk, which came with a top like you get with a bottle of beer. This lasted longer than regular milk, which meant it was cheaper, and that was rather vital, given that we were skint. I mean, skint. My second memory, just a flash, was heading for the bus to move to a new council estate, which was built in the 1950s on the outskirts of Leicester. This would be my home until I left to play professional football in 1967. I lived there for short periods later too, and my younger brother, Paul, still lives there. I also have an older brother, Trevor. Paul and I shared the same little bedroom after he arrived, and thankfully, the same sense of humour to this day. It's never long before we're laughing. My father, Beric, was born in 1907 and lived a challenging life growing up through the First World War and then struggling to survive the Great Depression of the 1930s. During the Depression, he walked 250 miles from London to Blackpool in the English Northwest and slept rough every night as he sought summer work on the Golden Mile of Blackpool's seafront area. He couldn't find a job even then, and walked a further 18 miles to Preston, where he secured work in a factory. Soon came World War II, when he volunteered for the medical corps. He always wanted to be a doctor, but his financial and social background made this impossible in class-ridden Britain. Nevertheless, he was a brilliant self-taught physician. We had a doctor called Radisky, or something like that, which, whether right or wrong, we pronounced Radisky. He was always writing a prescription before you finished saying how you felt. Time and again, I would tell my father about Radisky's diagnosis, and he would say he was wrong. Beric's medical conclusion invariably turned out to be correct. He served in the Middle East and North Africa during the war, and then up through Italy into Northern Europe. And this had a profound effect on him for the rest of his life. He would recount all the stories to me many times and how he was turned away from religion for life by seeing families and children living in abject poverty in places like Naples, surrounded by magnificent churches where clergy still ask the poor for money. Berwick was a rebel at heart and very suspicious of authority. He found it very difficult to walk away from injustice and lost many jobs by not accepting it. He was fired from a London pub for punching the owner, who was badly treating a young employee, and this led to his trek to Blackpool in search of work. Later, he was urged by fellow workers in a shoe factory to represent them over poor treatment by the bosses. And when he did, he was sacked on the spot. He told me how he picked up some possessions from his work spot and all those who urged him to represent them because they daren't sat with their heads down, refusing to make eye contact as he walked out with another income gone. It taught him, as my own experiences have taught me, never to do anything with the motivation of helping people. If you do that, you will be disappointed and hurt when those same people turn on you despite what you did for them. Instead, do what you know to be right. And by doing so, people are helped as a result. When they turn against you, the dynamic is different. You didn't do it for them. You did it because you knew it was the right thing to do. Your relationship is not with individuals. It is with doing what is right and just and fair because it is right and just and fair, irrespective of the people involved. That is how I live my life to this day. My father was a rebel in the military too and got away with a lot. He was willing to do things that others wouldn't do, which included picking up body parts of those blown to pieces and sending them home in coffins weighed down with ballast so their families believed it contained a full body when it was only a few pieces. The authorities needed him, and he took full advantage of that. He was part of a plan to falsely diagnose with tuberculosis a highly dangerous officer whose idiocy was getting many killed. The move ensured the officer would be sent home to England and no longer able to cause his deadly mayhem. When Berwick won the British Empire Medal for pulling pilots and crew from a crash-landed blazing plane at Chipping Warden Airfield in Oxfordshire, he became pretty much untouchable. He would be picked up from local pubs in the evening, poured into a truck, poured into bed, and be ready for work the next morning. No action was taken against him. He was too invaluable, and the medal was his protection. The Ike family has rebel in its DNA. Berwick's challenges and life experiences didn't make him the easiest man to live with. He was angry and frustrated at the world, and he could have a short fuse. Behind that was a sense of decency, and he cried easily at the sight of injustice. By contrast, I'm the opposite. Injustice doesn't make me cry. My response is to want to put it right. What makes me cry, very easily, is to see kindness and people joyful and happy. I'm a sucker for a weepy movie with a happy ending. I was brought up in an atmosphere of questioning authority and never giving up. My father told me at a young age, you are never finished until you tell yourself you are finished. It doesn't matter what anyone else says. That came in handy when the deluge of ridicule was turned upon me in 1991. My mother Barbara was very different. She was dragged around from place to place and home to home by my grandfather as she was growing up. She never had what you would call an education. My father said to me once, you've got your mother's looks and your father's brains, and thank God it wasn't the other way around. In fact, while not being in any way or sense an academic, Barbara was very streetwise about many things. My father needed her more than vice versa. She was incredibly loyal and the kind of woman you want next to you when the going gets tough, which during my childhood was pretty much all the time. I would go with her on a Thursday lunchtime to the Gents Clock Factory in Leicester's St Saviour's Road, where my father would slip out with his pay packet so we could eat that night. Barbara never complained and just got on with it. We kids didn't complain either. It was all we knew. You didn't miss what you'd never had in the days before mass marketing and desire manipulation to which subsequent generations have been subjected. When I was still in a pram, she would walk the streets to deliver to shops the toys my father made at Christmas to bring in a few more pennies. He would use round pie tins to make toy banjos. And the first Christmas present I remember was a big wooden bus that he made for me. My mother would tell the shops that she was delivering on my pram because the van had broken down. A van we never had. Then there were the many times council rent men knocked on the door and my mother would go shh to me and push me behind the settee. I didn't know what was happening at first, but I learned that when the rent man got no answer, he often didn't from people who couldn't pay the rent that week, he would peer through the front window. Hence, when we were in the front room at the time, we hid behind the settee. Berwick and Barbara were a great balance, if not always in harmony, to say the least. He was very much the angry man who could be very aggressive, and she was the feminine calm that he so badly needed. She was always singing when I was small as she cleaned the stone floor or polished the front step, which seemed to be an obsession with working-class women of the time. One of her regular songs around Christmas was The Little Boy That Santa Claus Forgot, most famously sung by wartime singing legend Vera Lynn. The song described how a little boy had no toys at Christmas while everyone else did. I would follow her around the house, telling her that he could have mine. It still brings tears to my eyes, remembering that, and don't play the song for me, whatever you do. One other point about my childhood is how it almost ended soon after it began. I was still very small when I was paddling in the North Sea at Caister near Great Yarmouth in Norfolk. I fell over and went under the water. I can clearly remember, as I write this, lying on my back, looking through the water to the sky. I made no effort to get up. Everything was so calm, and I was fine with just experiencing how lovely it all was. Then I saw the face of my brother, Trevor, appear above me, and his arm dipped in and pulled me out. The next thing I knew, I was lying on my belly on the beach, coughing up water. I've wondered if I would have just stayed there. But thanks to Trevor, I didn't find out. What a good job he was looking and saw what I'd done. Funny, even though I was not fazed by the experience in the moment, the coughing up of water and the struggle to breathe made me frightened of water for much of my childhood. I would claim I had forgot my swimming trunks to avoid school swimming lessons and didn't learn to swim until I was in my 30s. Another fear of mine as a kid was dogs. And when I walked anywhere, they always seemed to make me their target for attention and barking. Once I realized how reality works, I understood why they were picking up the energy I was giving off. I love dogs today. Their eyes and faces are magical. Looking back at my life and all that has happened, I came out of the womb symbolically wearing running shoes as I sprinted from experience to experience and emotion to emotion to glean as much knowledge as possible as quickly as possible. This related to what it is like and what it means to be human and how the human world is controlled. Obviously, I didn't know then why these experiences were happening. They were, however, essential to what my higher levels of consciousness knew was coming. Others who have clearly come here to roll back human control will no doubt recognize my roller coaster life experience. To understand how the game is played, you have to experience all significant parts of the game. I was sitting in a circle of people from all ages and walks of life one time, and as they told their personal stories, I was thinking, whoa, that happened to me. Yes, I know exactly how that feels, and crikey, I did that too. This is what I mean by the running shoes. I talk and write a lot about the little me mentality, in which people consider themselves powerless to impact on life. They are followers and reactors, not leaders and impactors. Little me is the foundation mentality of the matrix simulation and utterly essential to the few controlling the many. I understand little me. I was there myself once. Through my early years and when I first went to school, I kept myself to myself with my head down and lived life as the also-ran I thought that it was my destiny to be. It never occurred to me that anything special would ever happen. Special, different, and successful were only for others. My hand-to-mouth life experience in the 1950s and early 1960s just confirmed that my present would be my future. Keeping myself to myself, spending time alone and enjoying my privacy has been a lifelong trait, which is rather ironic given that almost everything I have done since I was 15 has been in the public eye in some way. The reason I seek out solitude has changed, however. Subsequently, this has been to withdraw from the public stage between public things that I do. As a kid, I was simply hiding from the world. I was shy in the extreme, had little to say, and my mother would laugh at me crossing the street to avoid even saying hello to someone. When I say shy, I mean it. I know what it's like, and I know how little me feels. I was frightened of everything. My first day at Whitehall Infant School was a nightmare for me. I ran home at lunchtime to tell my mother I didn't like school and I didn't want to go back again. My heart sank when she said that I had to. I was frightened every day. I was especially terrified of the dentist, and I remember going with my mother to have a tooth out at a school dental clinic. If I was going to the dentist, I would ask my mother if I could have something to eat on our walk there. I knew that if she said no, I was going to have a tooth pulled with the gas to knock me out. She used to keep that from me. She knew I might run for it, and this particular day, I did. The dentist lowered the gas mask to my face, and at the last second, I banged him in the chest, jumped up, did a body swerve around him, and ran full pelt out of the surgery, through the waiting room, and into the street. I kept running, with my mother, shopping bag on arm as always, shouting in the distance, "David, David, come back!" I turned around to see her running towards me, some way behind, and it dawned on me that there was nowhere to run. I had toothache, and it would not go away if I didn't return. The next day, one of the kids at school told me he was in the waiting room when I sped past. Another one of endless bad days for my self-esteem. In the years after we moved from slum clearance Lead Street to a new council house on a new estate, the road to Whitehall School was a dirt track. It was known locally, I seem to recall, as Cutthroat Lane. My father ran a campaign to get it paved, and decades later I found a picture from the local paper of the time reporting his efforts. The picture included my mother with me in my school cap as I was at Whitehall Infants. I had an experience at infant school about the same time, maybe 1958, that both typified me in that period and gave me a spooky precursor of where my life was much later to go. I was in a school play. School plays have been significant in my life, as we'll see. And of course, I played the starring role. I was a tree. Teacher's pet, Graham Glover, was the prince in our rendition of Sleeping Beauty, and good luck to him. The thought of saying lines in public would have been catastrophic for me. I was with a group of others dressed in brown trousers, green tops, and something on our heads supposed to be symbolic of branches. The idea was that the prince would cut down the trees with his make-believe scythe and we would fall down as he passed. I was playing it for real, and Graham Glover never came near me. So I thought, how can I fall when he's so far away? That would be silly. All the other trees fell down, no matter where he was, and I was left standing on my own. The audience of parents and teachers started to titter and then to belly laugh. I stood there thinking, why are they laughing? He didn't come near me, so how could I fall? The symbolism of refusing to fall while everyone else laughed at me was a sign of things to come. The next day I was called out of class by the headmistress, Miss Wilkinson. Think of a classic headmistress of the 1950s and you got her. Tall, wide, tweed skirt and jacket, and her shoulders so big she predated shoulder pads without any need to have them. She leaned over me like Cruella de Vil and launched into a rant about how I had made the play look foolish, the school look foolish, and myself look foolish. It was like that old joke about an inflatable boy who stabbed an inflatable headmaster at an inflatable school and then stabbed himself. The headmaster said, "You've let me down, you've let the school down, and worst of all, you've let yourself down." Well, I laughed anyway. Miss Wilkinson and the play were yet more blows to my self-esteem. But what a precursor and preparation for what was to come. I moved to Whitehall Junior School next door, and my life and demeanour eventually began to change thanks to football. The tarmac playground was on a slight incline, and we used to play a game called Uppers and Downers. Someone kicked a plastic football in the air, shouted, "Uppers and Downers," and everyone chose which team they wanted to play for, the ups or the downs. The teams could be seriously uneven as a result, but it sort of worked. I was attracted from the start by the position of goalkeeper, which was rare. Most kids wanted to score goals while I wanted to stop them. The playground is still there, as is the infant school hall where my tree refused to fall. I was walking into the school one day when I saw a notice on the door asking for anyone interested in a trial for the school third-year football team to add their name. I didn't think for a second to do so. Play for the school team? I would never get in, so what's the point? I was walking home alone shortly afterwards when a boy ran behind me shouting for me to stop. He said the football teacher, Mr. Rickard, wanted me to go to the trial for the team the next day. He said he'd seen me playing in goal in the playground. I ran home so excited to tell my father. Then it dawned on me that I had no football boots. We had no money for boots, and I had no need for them till now. Anyway, the shops were closed by the time my father came back from work. Shops then had strict opening hours. There were no supermarkets open all day and night. There were no supermarkets, period. I went with him to the nearest shops where there was any chance of finding football boots, in the hope that one was still open by chance. It was a forlorn hope. Then we found a tiny shop in Leicester's Green Lane Road that sold bric-a-brac. There, in the window, was a pair of football boots, and it was still open. The problem comes with my description of them as football boots. Yes, they were boots, and yes, they could kick a ball. That's where the comparison ended. First of all, they were colossal adult boots, far too big for me, and they would have been state-of-the-art in about 1915. By this time, you were more likely to see a diver in a big metal helmet wearing them to aid his submersion. They had an enormous toe cap and cost 7 shillings and 6 pence, the equivalent today, a converter tells me, of 38 pence. Even then, they were overpriced. I went for the trial the next day as a goalkeeper, with my boots attracting great hilarity. Another boy was picked in goal and I had to somehow get into the team playing outfield. It came down to me and one other kid for the last position, and Mr. Rickard decided to have us both take a shot at goal, and the one with the most powerful shot would get in. Well, this was going to be a no contest. I had boots with toe caps that could have launched missiles. I kicked the ball, toe cap first, and it begged for mercy when contact was made. I was in. I can't tell you the rush of self-esteem this gave a little boy without any up to that point. My eyes still water thinking about it even today. My God, I can achieve things. I scored in my first game for the school, a goal my father missed. He tended to leave home just when he was supposed to arrive somewhere else. When he did come, I ran over to him shouting, "I scored! I scored!" Mind you, that was not much of a great achievement, given that we won 16-0 against a Catholic school called the Newry, who were to football what Bill Gates is to human decency. Soon afterwards, the goalkeeper picked in front of me went to play for the fourth year team, and I was now in goal. I decided immediately what I wanted to be: a professional footballer. What an ambition for the kid who 2 weeks earlier thought he would never amount to anything. I played for the fourth year team the next season, and we won a cup in which all the schools in Leicester could enter. It was an incredible achievement. Hey, this Ike kid might not be an also-ran after all. I should mention something else in regard to this. While I had low self-esteem up to this point and didn't expect to amount to much, there was actually a big contradiction running alongside that. From somewhere deep inside, from an early age, I felt I had come to do something. Like a destiny, if you like. It was coming from a different place to my conscious lack of belief in myself. It was there as a feeling more than a thought. The feeling would just come and go here and there. When I set my sights on being a footballer, I thought, that might be this destiny I had the feeling about. There were another couple of incidents that stick in the memory at Whitehall Junior School, and when I look back, they were not random. They were me being guided through the human maze and activating traits that would be essential in my future life, which I had no idea was coming. Other levels of me did, though. What I call body-mind, the five senses basically, are only part of our multidimensional consciousness. We are much more than that if we open our minds to expanded states of consciousness. If we don't, our perception becomes entrapped in five-sense myopia, and we are a manipulator's dream. Body-mind is like a guy paddling down the river in a canoe. The limit of his vision and awareness is the next turn on the river. Our expanded awareness, beyond the simulation, beyond the perception of the five senses, can view the whole river from source to sea. What means one thing to body-mind means something very different to expanded awareness. For example, the canoe might spring a leak and you paddle to the shore furious at your bad luck. Then someone comes over to you and says, "My God, you were lucky. There's a big waterfall around that next corner." These situations have happened to me throughout my life, and not only since my initial conscious awakening in 1990. I began to recognize them after that, but they had been happening since I was a young kid. They appeared to be just coincidences and bits of luck until I became aware enough to see the pattern and realize something strange was happening that could not be explained by mere coincidence. This revelation would be decades away, however, as I made my way through the school system. In the third year at Whitehall, I was told by the fourth-year football teacher to ask my own class teacher for permission to take part in the weekly football training afternoon, which fourth-year boys had written into the curriculum. I asked the first week and he said yes, and then the second week, when I was out playing in goal, a kid from my class came over and said I had to return immediately. When I did, I was humiliated in front of everyone by a morose arsehole of a teacher. I thought permission had been given to go to football every week. He didn't. Something inexplicable followed. I sat down at my desk and he set a class spelling test. Now, I'm not bad at spelling these days through decades of repetition and there's always spell check. In my school days, I was useless. At the end of the class, the teacher announced the spelling test results. Somehow, I'd come top. What, me? At spelling? I must say I enjoyed his embarrassment amid my own incredulity when he had to reveal that the boy he had just lambasted in front of everyone and didn't think was very bright had won his test. It was from here that I began to develop a fuck you attitude to anyone who sought to belittle me and put me down. It came in handy after 1990. That same year, with the same teacher, I came top of the class at the end of the year exams for the single time in my life. It was the only point in my school career that I had really tried. I was going to be a professional footballer. I knew it. And so why did I need all this school crap? There was, in fact, another reason unbeknown to me. Why do I need all this perception programming? The other incident I recall was in my final year at Whitehall when I had a teacher that showed me some respect. He sent a very fragile piece of slate around the class, and when it was given to me by the boy in front, I broke it in two by accident, testing how strong it was. Oh, no. I watched the now two pieces continuing their journey back to the teacher, who was furious when he was given two pieces instead of one. Who broke the slate? Came the cry. Silence followed. Could I get away with it? I thought that I had until he went around the class asking each child in turn if it was broken when it got to them. I could see that the only way I was going to survive was to say it was broken when it came to me, so blaming the boy in front. I could never do that, and so I was left to my fate. In fact, the teacher, a decent man, didn't fume. He said how disappointed he was that I didn't own up immediately. That hurt more than any rollicking. The good thing was that I refused to protect myself by blaming someone else, which I could have done. That attitude has stayed with me ever since, and it is amazing how apparently random little incidents and choices, especially in childhood, can have a profound impact on you for life. Being a professional footballer was all that mattered to me as I moved on from Whitehall to a senior school, Crown Hills Secondary Modern, in 1963. Whitehall is still there pretty much as it was, while Crown Hills has a school of the same name on the same site, but with a ferociously ugly building, replacing the unique one that I knew. I was supposed to go from Whitehall to another school called Spencefield, where they played rugby, not football. And a group of us got permission instead to go to Crown Hills, which was fantastic on so many fronts. There was a big staff change at the same time I arrived. And while schoolwork was never my priority, to say the least, I had an amazing 4 years. The great majority of the teaching staff were brilliant, and I can still recall their names, Mr. Danvers, Stone, Jay, Hartley, Duggan, Woodcock and Jones. The state curriculum was, of course, designed to mould young minds in ways that suited the state, but not even close to the scale of perceptual programming that we see today. Those teachers at Crown Hills allowed me a freedom of thought and expression that the young of current generations would hardly believe. They were also great characters, often very funny, and went the extra mile to help and support the kids when they didn't have to. It was a different age and a far better one. I was getting a bit rebellious by now. Schoolwork bored me and I couldn't see how much of it would ever be of use in the life I had in mind. At the same time, being at the school with my mates and in that teaching atmosphere was a joy I have never forgotten. My French teacher, a lovely lady called Madame Barwood, would often make it her first priority at the start of each lesson, especially the late Friday one, for some reason, to find an excuse to eject me to the corridor. She knew I wasn't interested in learning French, so what was the point in me being there, I guess, was her conclusion. I still liked her, though, and when I met her in the street years after I left, we had a good laugh about it. To this day, the only phrase in French I remember is "Quelle heure est-il?" or something like that. If you are ever in Paris and want to know the time, I'm your man. The headmaster, a guy called Oldfield, and a rare one I didn't really take to, would teach a class next door on Fridays and would often come out to take a phone call and give me the double take as I stood alone in the corridor. "What, you? Again?" I wasn't a surly rebel, a rebel in search of a cause. It was just that I wasn't interested in most of what they tried to teach me. I instinctively knew that I would never have a need for much of it, and so it has proved. Most of what interested me, like history, I've spent decades unlearning because it simply wasn't true, or at least only partly so. At the start of each school year, I would be near the front of the queue for the new classrooms, so I would get my seat for the year next to the windows which looked out on the sports field. I spent many hours daydreaming out of the window, as I spend so much of my life still daydreaming today. Daydreaming is my form of meditation, letting the mind go where it wants without limitation. "Ike, look this way," and "Ike, stop daydreaming," was a regular response from the teachers trying to fill my head with maths, or whatever. My mind was only on the job with English, writing, not the rest of it, history and geography. The rest passed me by. Oh yes, and there was also art with a top teacher, Tony Danvers. He encouraged kids to be creative even if you couldn't draw or paint. Guilty. I did a symbolic representation with Tony's encouragement of the great England goalkeeper, Gordon Banks, my hero at the time, made from plaster and wire. Tony entered the work in an art exhibition, the one and only time that would ever happen in my life, given that I was crap. Gordon wasn't very good, to be honest, and made Banks look like the winner in a pie-eating competition. Tony was one outstanding teacher and made art what it should be, fun. It was a delight to make contact with him before I began writing this book, and he provided some of the pictures. I remember so much about my time at Crown Hills, almost all of it with affection. But again, there were key moments with hindsight that affected me deeply in terms of preparing me for what was to come. There was a school bully who, like all bullies, frightened people into submission with the fear of the consequences of not doing what he said. The consequences didn't have to be delivered. The thought of them was enough. See humanity for thousands of years and more. One day, he and the group of boys around him, all of them cowards, stopped speaking to me and the verbal bullying started, which went on for weeks. I was 13 at the time. The bully would often threaten to beat me up. My father saw that I was not happy and asked me what was wrong. When I told him, he said, "Right, go to school, pick out the main one, and tell him you'll take him on." The message was that if you have a problem, look it in the eye and deal with it. If you have a bully, don't be cowed into compliance. The next school day, the bully came to me with his gang behind him and told me to wait after school in the boys' toilets. He was going to, yes, beat me up. I can still see his face when I replied, "Okay, I'll be there." That wasn't the response he was expecting. I was alone in the toilets after all the other kids went home, and in walked the bully with his gang. He then spent the next 15 minutes or so trying to hit me and never once did. Whatever he threw, I blocked. It was a slowed-down version of Neo in The Matrix. When I went towards him and appeared to be trying to hit him, I wasn't, but he didn't know, he backed off like a frightened Moggy. Oh, so this was the big bad bully, when his bluff was called. He swept out, his gang trailing behind, still yet to land a single punch. The next day, they all started talking to me again, and the bullying stopped. To this day, I will not stand aside in the face of a bully, no matter who it may be, from an official in a luminous jacket to the psychopaths behind mass human control. This was another apparently passing childhood experience that had a profound effect on me from then on. I played for Crown Hill's football teams for 3 years, many times outfield in the first two, and my chances to be a footballer were disappearing. To be seen by scouts at professional clubs, you had to be playing for your city representative team. The thought was that if you couldn't get into your city team, you couldn't be good enough to be of interest to football clubs. I was nowhere near doing that. Then came the break that set me on the road to the ambition that began with those giant boots years earlier. There was a trial for the Leicester School's under-14 team, and my sports teacher, a great guy called Mr. Stone, sent me along with a few others. The catch was that he sent me as an outfield player. It was taken for granted that the goalkeeper selected would be a boy called Dave Valance. He was already playing a year up for the under-15 Leicester Schools team, and naturally, he would be picked for his own age group as well. I turned up on a cold and misty morning, with the grass dripping with dew, in an area now known as Ellis Meadows, and I think connected at the time to the old John Ellis School. They played games of half an hour with different groups of trialists, and I was pretty useless outfield at this level. My heart wasn't in it. I was a goalkeeper, and that's all I wanted to be. The teacher in charge told about four of us to go and kick a ball around in an area away from the pitch, and he would call us back if he needed us again. It was clearly thanks, but no thanks. I walked away, pondering on where my ambition could possibly go from here. About 5 minutes later, I heard a shout from the teacher in the distance. "Hey, any of you lads playing goal?" I was running towards him in a flash. "Yes, I do!" The other goalkeeper, with Valance, had been injured, and I took over. I did okay, and the teacher told me afterwards that I should come to the next trial because, quote, "we need a reserve goalkeeper to Dave Valance." Well, the next trial took the form of a full game between two teams of the surviving trialists, and the selection produced one team far more talented than the other, with me in the other. I was bombarded with shots from all angles for the totality of the game, and it was one of those days when if I had dived the wrong way, the ball would have somehow hit me and stayed out. I was inspired. My goal was battered throughout, and only one shot went past me. Talk about the performance of my life at exactly the right time. The teacher manager, to be fair, said that as I had played so well in the trial, he had to pick me for the team. We had the strange situation in which Valance was playing for the under-15 team and couldn't get into the under-14 team. A scout from Arsenal Football Club saw me play for the team a few weeks later, and I went on trial there during the week that England won the World Cup in 1966 for the only time. The whole England squad came over to the Arsenal training ground in the week before the final at Wembley, when the players not in the main team played a training game against Arsenal. I stood on the touchline alongside these world-famous players, including the captain, Bobby Moore, and my hero, the then Leicester City goalkeeper, Gordon Banks. What a dream for a kid who loved football. I'd learned the skills of goalkeeping by watching Banks week after week from behind the goal at Leicester's former ground, Filbert Street. Arsenal asked me to sign what were called schoolboy forms with them, but my father wanted to hold on. Another famous goalkeeper that I knew in schools football in Leicester was Peter Shilton, who played for the Leicester City first team at just 16 and went on to play more games for England than any other player, 125, and holds the all-time record for the most competitive appearances in world football, 1,390. I could have signed for Leicester, but at the time, Gordon Banks was in the first team and Peter Shilton was his reserve, and I thought it best to go somewhere else. I was picked ahead of Dave Valance for the under-15 Leicester boys team the next season and for the Leicestershire County Schools team. Everything took off. I was recommended for trials by scouts for Liverpool, Nottingham Forest, Blackpool, Millwall and others. My father was adamant that he wanted me to have a trial first with Coventry City, then managed by a flamboyant character called Jimmy Hill. He had taken them from third division obscurity to the top division in the season I joined them in 1967. I played only half an hour in the trial game before they offered me a full-time contract. Coventry was 25 miles from Leicester, and it meant I could get home at weekends after matches. Here I was, 6 years after my big boots trial at Whitehall, leaving school behind to be a professional footballer. Would that have happened without the goalkeeper getting injured at the Leicester under-14 trial after I had first been rejected? A great deal less likely, it is fair to say. These are the coincidences and bits of luck that have peppered my life throughout. Success in football had saved me. God knows what I would have done otherwise. Even as a kid, the thought of working in a factory or office where most of my schoolmates ended up was excruciating. I did not have the mind for that. Where would we be without people working in factories and offices in terms of production and organization? I know that. And I'm not knocking those that take that path. It's just that I would have died of boredom, and I knew that from a very early age. Thank goodness for football, which gave me a way out. Leaving Crown Hills was still a big blow, despite where I was going. I had loved my 4 years there, when I could dream about being a footballer and all that I wanted to do. Now, I had to make that happen in a very different environment. In the last year of school, I only had to turn up for a trial to know I would be picked as my confidence and ability blossomed. Here I was, going away to another city to compete with people older and better or just as good. My relationship with football was bound to change, and it did. I left Crown Hills to pursue my ambition with a heavy heart. Bye-bye, Crown Hills. Thanks for the memories. There was also a girl still at the school in the year below me. that I wanted to stay in touch with. I was extremely attracted to her, and she to me. I was in love with her, actually, or as much as a 15-year-old can know what that means. We wrote every week for a few months when I went to Coventry, before she dropped me suddenly and without explanation out of the blue. I have never known why. But bizarrely, and I do mean bizarrely, she came back into my life 52 years later. Well, not her in the literal sense, but you'll see what I mean later in the book. I was about to live my dream, and I now knew why, since I was a kid, that I had the feeling of being here to do something. I was here to be a footballer. Yes, that was it. Right?